Welcome to Christ the Center, your weekly conversation of Reformed theology. This is episode number 852. My name is Camden Busey. I'm in Libertyville, Illinois, at the Reformed Forum headquarters in the studio. I'm excited to be with Scott Hatch, Scott J. Hatch, who is an author. He has a BA in political science from the University of New Hampshire. He's got an MA in religion from RTS in Washington and now a THM from Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia. But he's also the author of a new book, Van Til and the Foundation of Christian Ethics, published by Reform Forum. It's published by us here. Welcome, Scott. It's great to see you. Welcome to the program. It's good to have you with us.
Great to be on the program.
We're really happy to have you. I'm excited to announce this book on the podcast. It's been out for a little while. We took it to the Greenville Conference with us kind of semi-secretly to make it known to people, but we've had a lot of going on in terms of the news pipeline and whatnot. We didn't want to step on any toes in terms of other courses or events or projects that we had up our sleeve. We want to give this the full space and the breadth that it needs in order for people to take and receive it and turn their attention to it. So we're doing that today in this episode. This is a really excellent treatment. We're happy to have this book, and we're going to dive in and discuss it today. And we're happy to have Scott with us. We're going to talk about a lot of this in just a few moments. But I have a few things to mention regarding this book. First off, if you love Cornelius Van Til, you're going to want to get a copy of this because more than 100 pages of this book is an appendix that actually includes Van Til's Christian Theistic Ethics. We'll talk about that, but it's a special, never-before-seen critical edition that Scott, the author here and editor of that section, has put together. So already, we should have put Van Til's name on the front kind of in some way, but we wanted to give Scott's work, original work, the main billing. But if you don't know, more than 100 pages of this, about a third of this book is Van Til's work in a format that you've never seen before in an organized way. We'll talk about that more. But secondly, the book's also available for sale right now at reformedforum.org/store. It's normally $27.99. We're going to be running a sale for a while. If you're listening to this in April 2024, jump on the sale. We're going to be having it for $19.99 with free U.S. shipping. And Reformation Heritage Books is also selling the book. They're going to be running some deals on it, I'm told. And they've bought some cases from us. And especially if you're outside the U.S., you're going to want to head on over to Reformation Heritage Books because we don't ship out overseas, but the book is available. Head on over to Reformation Heritage. We'll have links to all this in the episode description for you to get your copy of the book. All right. All that being said now, Scott, it's great to have you with us. I'm looking forward to discussing Van Til and the Foundation of Christian Ethics, a God-centered approach to moral philosophy. First thing I should mention to you, or at least get your reaction, is did you ever think this would finally come out? It's been a long project, not only as a THM thesis, but then the long and arduous process of writing and editing and all the different stages, working with a young and inexperienced publisher. Scott, did you ever think you'd see the day when we'd be talking about this and holding copies in our hands?
The thing that surprised me, not that it's taken long, because when I was working on this, I was thinking, okay, publishing takes a while. So that I understood. The fact that I even wrote a book on ethics is surprising to me. You know, if you had asked me 10 years or told me 10 years ago, you're going to write a book on ethics, I would have been like, maybe something else, but not ethics.
Yeah. Yeah, it is amazing. And let people know a bit about how you were introduced to this subject. I want to hear about your THM studies and how you were brought to study ethics specifically and the ethics of Cornelius Van Til. But how were you introduced to Van Til more generally speaking? How did you come upon his theology and his apologetics?
Back in the early 90s, without getting into a whole lot of thing about how I grew up and all that, in the early 90s, I started going to a Presbyterian church. And by that point, I had attended a number of different churches. So I started taking seminary classes as a way of figuring out, what is it that I actually believe? Mm-hmm. And one of those classes was on apologetics. And they used Van Til's Defense of the Faith. So that was my first exposure to Van Til. Reading it was like I kind of get what he's saying. It really seems to click, but I didn't have enough of a background at the time to appreciate Van Til. When I did my seminary studies at RTS, I don't recall that we had used Van Til all that much. We used a lot of John Frame's books. How I actually got into this particular thing of studying ethics was, you know, for a number of years, I had been teaching a Sunday school class at the McLean Presbyterian Church, and we were working our way through the Old Testament. So we got to 1 Samuel 21, which is the story about David when he's fleeing from Saul, and that presents a lot of ethical issues right there, because he's not honest in what he tells the priest. But then, you know, looking at that from a question of the priest are being honest and they get killed for it. Doeg the Edomite is honest to a malicious end. David is dishonest. How do you sort all that out? And we ended up having a much more heated discussion than I thought we would. And so I had some of the folks in the class come up to me afterwards and say, well, have you read John Murray's book, Principles of Conduct? And I said, well, no, I hadn't. Well, you have to read that. Okay, fine, I'll read that. So I figured I would do like a crash course on various books on ethics. So I read Murray's Principles of Conduct from my seminary days. I had Oliver O'Donovan's Resurrection and the Moral Order, had Frame's magnum opus of Doctrine of the Christian Life. I knew of Klein's article on intrusion ethics, and my wife had a copy of Van Til's Christian Theistic Ethics. Because a gentleman who had discipled her before we had gotten married used that with her. And so I looked at it and I'm like, well, it's short. I'll throw that on the stack too. And then I'll get right through these things and then I'll be done with it. I'll move on to something else. And just reading that book, I was like, this is so totally different than anything else I've read on ethics.
Right.
And I was like, intrigued as to why is this so different. It seems to bring everything together. It seems to make everything click. So when I applied to Westminster with a THM program, of course you need to come up with a thesis, at least going in. You can change it all once you get in there. And some of the other things that I was interested in, I couldn't really come up with a good thesis question, but I could, in coming back to Van Til and going, okay, why is this book so different? How does this book fit into everything else that he wrote? And why Van Til on ethics? That's a simplified version, but that's basically what I put down on the application. So when I got in and was starting to take classes at Westminster, there was one thing in which I thought I'd sketch out some of these ideas in a paper. And in the paper, I asked one of the archivists at the library, how long did Van Til actually teach ethics and when did he turn it over to John Murray? Thinking he did this as a, you know, he didn't publish any books on it. He only had the syllabus of Christian Theistic Ethics. And she came back and said, he didn't turn it over to John Murray. And that just floored me. It turned out what had happened was he taught the class from the time that he took over, that when he came to Westminster in 1929, 1930. And then he and Murray team taught, they expanded into two courses, and they team taught it from basically 1941 until about the late 50s.
Wow.
So he had a lot more exposure, a lot more engagement with ethics than I had known, and I think anyone else had known. So that's kind of how I got into studying Van Til on ethics.
Yeah, it becomes intriguing at that point. It's always fun to be digging around in the archives and talking with the archivist. I presume that was Grace Mullen at the time that you were speaking with, or was it after Grace's time?
It was after Grace's time. It
Okay.
was Carla.
Oh, yes. Okay. Carla, yes. Yeah, we remember Carla. That's delightful. You're able to dig down and dive into those archives and to find out and piece together some of this history, because this book is very significant, but I doubt if many people who even really love Van Til have copies or have read it. Christian Theistic Ethics, that is. And that was one of the things that I'm so excited to talk about today, but also wanted to get this book out into the wild, is so that we could include this and then include a primary, source reading, or I should say, an original work that's dealing with some of this material as well, even as we're including the primary source, Christian Theistic Ethics, in a new form. So, how did that make you feel when you've figured this out and you're starting to look at Van Til's teaching, his history of having more ethics involvement than we might have expected? Did you immediately start thinking about writing papers, or were you working towards this larger project all along, or did this come about a little bit later in your studies?
The way I'd thought about it was I was using several of the papers in the classes to actually build towards this,
Sure.
or at least on issues related to it. And when I actually started on the thesis proper, I went back to the archivist. By this point, it was Bob McGinnis, and was asking him for a little bit more detail of anything else that might be in the archives about Van Til ethics, because it wasn't like there was a lot of people that had really interacted with this. There was only
Right.
the syllabus that was published by the Dendelk Foundation. And Bob came back with an email and said, "I found a whole file that says Van Til ethics. Do you think that'd be relevant?" I'm like, "Yeah, I think that would be very relevant." So I came up and took a look at what he had, and I felt like I had hit the gold mine. It was, and this is part of what's in the book, his original syllabus was a 1930 syllabus that laid out some of the general ideas, but then he revised it considerably in 1941 and expanded it to the form that it would, the fundamental form that it would take. Then there was also a 1947 revision. He did a few other revisions over the years. I think I'd ordered actually from Reform Forum when you guys were pulling together media things, a copy of a 1951 syllabus that he had, and you let me borrow another syllabus as well for the research. But then the final form of the book is also rather different, because the first part of Christian theistic ethics is what he had taught for the better part of 30 years. The second part of Christian theistic ethics in the syllabus that you can get today was actually not taught. I think it was probably a graduate level class that he was thinking about teaching in the early 60s. And it's not clear to me that class was ever taught. So he just married the two together when he was getting close to retirement. And so then it was a matter of, okay, now we have several syllabi. How does this change over time? Does he take a lot of stuff out? Does he add a lot of stuff in? And why does it change? And how does that mesh up with what he had actually, his career trajectory?
That's what's so interesting about what you've done and what we've tried to convey in this book is it includes all the layers of changes. So this is why it's handy for scholars, especially Van Tilian scholars, but even more broadly, because you get a sense of how Van Til developed his thought over time through this particular work. And we've included, so Scott has put all of this together, and we have the original numbers here, but there are markings within the text itself that indicate whether this was an addition and when, or whether it happened to be a deletion and when. So you basically get it all in one form where you can read it from beginning to end. It's not in columns, but it's all in one work, but you can once you get the hang of the markings, which are not intrusive, but they're easy to see. But once you learn them, you can pretty quickly understand, you know, what vintage this was. So explain to us and to the listeners, Scott, the process of figuring that all out and piecing that together. And what kinds of things did you learn as you were really doing kind of like critical work? But I guess like this is kind of like archaeological work on Van Til's book.
Yeah, that was really fun. It was what I ended up doing the way methodologically. What I did was I had logos. So I, as part of the thesis project, I just bought the entire library of logos.
Yeah.
On Van Til.
Sure.
So I could have an electronic file. And then I went through, I had taken, with the help of the archivist, I had taken photos of all of the text from the 1930 version and the 1941 version, and then just went through and started doing essentially line edits so that I could have one version that had everything in there. And for this book, what I've done is a lot of the stuff that were either major additions to what we to the 1941 version or major deletions, those are highlighted in the appendices. What was interesting in, I mean, one of the things that I learned that I saw, we have talked, scholars have talked for a long time about Van Til's methodological consistency. You know, he's not changing a lot of his methodology over the years, and you right. could actually see that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he's taking things out, I didn't include it in, you know, the book that we have here, but in the originals, you could see where he had made handwritten statements about, he'd put in dates, for example. And I think he's reading his syllabus. He's going through that in class. So he's just making a notation. This is the day I got to this point. And so then you could see when he's taking certain text out, he's not doing a major rewrite. He's just doing a deletion, change the sentence a little bit, bring it together, and then that's the new version. So yeah, his thinking is not evolving tremendously, but it, in the sense that he's not reversing himself or going off in new directions. He's either expanding or contracting based on what he could actually teach in a given time. Some of the evolutions, the 1941, you think about where he was in the 1930s. He was at Westminster. He was teaching. The OPC would eventually be founded. Yeah, he's involved with that. So the 1930 version laid out some general ideas, the priorities that he had, for example, on what is the highest good, what is the summum bonum. He had a little bit of a history of ethics, but he doesn't really continue that. The 1941 version, he's really expanding out these ideas in a biblical theology approach. And then in 1947, he's making some notable changes. He's not changing the overall structure. But what's interesting is what he's taking, what he's putting in and what he's cutting out. You know, he's putting in a lot of things that are dealing with Arminianism and Roman Catholicism. He's taking out things that, in some respect, were more explanatory. He had a long section on understanding the will of man in relationship to the will of God, which shows that he was actually familiar with Reformed scholasticism that stuff.
Right.
So he ended up cutting that out. And I think, again, it was mostly for space reasons. Some of the changes in 1947, especially the introduction of a lot of polemics against Catholicism, that was one thing I was never able to really fully explain. My working hypothesis on that was what he ended up doing. That was about the time that he would have been writing the new modernism. So he would have been dealing with Bartianism and given Bart's attitude towards Roman Catholicism. I think Van Til felt he needed to figure out where he agreed or disagreed with Roman Catholicism vis-a-vis where he, in his critique of Bardianism. That's my hypothesis, but there's other things going on at the time. You know, you have America just come out of World War II. Roman Catholicism is actually getting more prominence publicly. So there are some interesting developments in that regard. It does, the form of the book doesn't really change all that much through the 1940s and 1950s. And then the latter stuff that is in the final edition of Christian Theistic Ethics, as I said, that looks to me like he was expanding on some ideas of trying to really get at more foundational stuff and how this relates to ancient philosophy and the parallels to today.
Absolutely.
But there's just some fascinating stuff coming out of all of that.
You know, as we eventually turn our attention to your original contribution here, in addition to the wonderful editing work that you've done on Van Til's work, but before we get to discussing your THM thesis now edited in book form, what you've highlighted some of Van Til's contribution to Christian ethics, but how is his approach distinct or unique among others? What is useful about Van Til's approach? Why did it stand out for you originally when you were reading it in comparison to all the other books on Christian ethics that you were addressing early on in your studies?
You know, one of the things, and you see this in Van Til's stuff, he spends probably about 60% of his syllabus talking about the man's highest good. You look at other books on ethics, if there's a mention at all about man's highest good, it's usually very brief. So that was one thing that stood out. The other thing, and this is a point I picked up from John Frame, and I think this is a valid observation, is that it's in Christian Theistic Ethics that Van Til is actually doing more biblical exegesis than he does in a lot of his more notable works. You can really, you know, he spends several chapters talking about effectively the different states of man, and then, you know, the Old Testament sonum bonum, the New Testament sonum bonum. He's really laying out more of a biblical theology here than you see in certainly other works that he's done. And with that, I think you can really see the influence of Gerhardus Voss. That kind of approach and the covenantal approach that he's taken really, I think, in modern terms of ethics, would be a narrative ethics. That term wasn't around when he was writing it. He was simply, you know, working with covenantal theology. The other thing that I think struck me as unusual, and this is different than a lot of other folks, is he's not spending a lot of time elucidating specific principles. You know, a lot of folks in the field of ethics will be talking about, here are some sources of ethical principles. We take these principles, we can derive other things. Here's situations for how to apply them. He's not doing that. I don't think he's against that. I mean, he wrote a whole separate thing on the Ten Commandments, and he taught a course on that back in the 30s. But he's not, you know, this is not a book that's focused on trying to delineate different ethical principles. And I think that's an interesting thing because, and this goes back to what I was saying at the outset in terms of why I'm surprised that I'm writing a book on ethics, is a lot of stuff on ethics, a lot of the works that I've encountered have been, here's an abstract principle, here's an abstract principle, here's a virtue, another virtue, here's a situation, they clash, isn't life difficult, go figure it out.
Right.
I'm like, well, that's not terribly helpful. You know, he's getting at a lot of foundational things that you don't really think about until you start wrestling with ethics a lot. For example, one of the foundational things is, what is the normative state of man? It sounds very abstract, but when you're talking about ethics, you're talking about going from the is to the ought. You know, what is now to what ought to be. So what is the normal state that we're working with? And using and taking the biblical theology approach that he does, he's starting with the normal state of man, so to speak, is man in the garden, not man as sinful. You know, that sets up a whole different thing of what the ought to be, because it shows that there is a difference, that the fall has made a real difference. And then he looks at that as eschatologically, you know, we're not simply going back to the garden. We're looking at what we would be in the consummation.
Yeah, absolutely.
I just don't see that in a lot of other works on ethics. You may get folks that will talk about eschatological ethics, but they are not talking about this in terms of a biblical, the arc of biblical narrative.
Mm-hmm. That is a wonderful contribution. So we're seeing the full scope of covenant history, redemptive history, post-fall, and how Van Til is understanding ethics in light of what God has revealed in Scripture. It's really not much of anything different from what he does in terms of apologetics. Van Til could have been a systematician. He's often known as being an apologist, but here we see he's an ethicist. But in all these endeavors, he's really trying to apply a thoroughgoing exegesis and a reformed understanding of Scripture in from beginning to end to a specific discipline. And that's one thing I love about him. Do you find that to be the case?
Yes, indeed. In fact, you know, one other thing, I think this is central. I got 2/3 of the way through writing the thesis before it really dawned on me why he called the book what he did. Because if you read Christian Theistic Ethics, he talks a little bit about at the beginning about, well, we could call it this, we could call it Christian ethics, but it's kind of milquetoast. but going through about 2/3 of the way, I'm like, oh, theistic ethics. Everything that he's doing centers on the doctrine of God.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not only God as the summum bonum, it's God as the anchor point,
mm-hmm.
God as the basis for our understanding of metaphysics, our basis for understanding epistemology, consequently, our basis for understanding ethics. You know, Van Til's putting all this stuff together. I had, as I was writing this, back when I was writing the thesis, I had lunch one day with Chad Van Dixhorn because he was down here at RTSDC. And he knew I was writing something on ethics. This was right before he went up to Westminster. Mm-hmm. And so it was a going away lunch. And Chad had just come off of teaching a course on modern theology and had made the comment of, yeah, modern theology really shipwrecks over the issue of ethics. And he asked rhetorically, it's like, why couldn't someone do for ethics what Van Til did for apologetics? And I said, well, about that. I think Van Til kind of did, actually.
He did. Well, maybe we'll have a mail copy this book over to Chad if he doesn't have one already. We'll make sure that he's got that. I appreciate that. It's a funny story. On that point, though, we talk so much at Reformed Forum about Van Til and his doctrine of the Trinity, of course. One of our fellows, Lane Tipton, has written a book on Van Til's Trinitarian theology. That's an important book, not only because we're talking about the doctrine of God, but especially as Van Til presented it, and which I think he rightly presented it, it is the foundation for all things. The title of your book here is Van Til and the Foundation of Christian Ethics. But for Van Til, one of the key aspects of his ethical system, as you mentioned, is its grounding in the Reformed doctrine of God, or as Van Til would so often say in many of his works, the self-contained ontological trinity. So how does that grounding influence the way Christians should think about moral decision-making, ethical dilemmas? It seems like a very obvious point if we're Christians and believe that God is the creator and sustainer of the universe, that the doctrine of God, the nature of who he is, ought to be at the center of everything. But most Christian ethics even won't acknowledge that. So what does that actually change when we're consistent with that belief? How does that approach differ from so many others?
You know, I think by focusing on the doctrine of God, it just brings everything together in a way that makes it click. I'm not sure I'm going to explain this well, but for me, reading through Van Til and reading and working through this stuff, it, you know, when you realize it's not simply that God gave us the Ten Commandments or moral commands, it's that who God is sets the basis for how we know everything else, sets the basis. You know, one of the issues in ethics is how do you deal with the issue of conscience? Well, when you come back to the a reformed understanding of the doctrine of God and the doctrine of sin, then you recognize that conscience can be seared. Conscience may not be fully reliable. So you need, how are you going to deal with an unreliable conscience? Well, you deal with that by having a word outside of yourself, hence biblical revelation. So the system of revelation, one, strengthens the anchor point. Two, one of the things Van Til shows is that, you know, the idea of what is absolute, you don't get absolutes in anything other than God.
Right, right.
I think it also helps bring together even the way that we think, because we tend to compartmentalize things. So we have our ethics over on the one hand. We'll talk about that in public theology, et cetera, et cetera. And then we talk about sanctification in a separate thing. Whereas in a realistic manner, my sanctification, for example, on let's just say, pick an issue, you know, sexual ethics, you know, being sanctified in that also feeds into how I should view the broader issue of how that exists in society. You know, they're not two separate spheres. They're one sphere. I think also when you start looking at a lot of ethical issues, there are deeper implications for the doctrine of God in the doctrine of man. I was talking with my wife about this over lunch earlier today and saying that, you know, I'm a PCA guy. Mm-hmm. And in the PCA, we've been wrestling with this issue for the last 5 years of so-called Psi B gay attraction, same-sex attraction. Going back to the Revoice conference in 2018, I'm not going to rehearse all the ins and outs of all of that, but you know, as the denomination was wrestling with this over time, it moved from being an issue simply of the biblical understanding of sexuality is that homosexuality is against the biblical understanding. We didn't move away from that. We didn't deny that. But as people started talking more and more about it and we started wrestling with things, we started seeing, wait a minute, if you're saying this, if some of the claims that were being made, that same-sex attraction, that people are just made that way, that sure. God made them that way, then you're saying, but God also says it's wrong, then you're setting up a contradiction within God himself. And then you're also getting into issues of, as people were making claims that, well, we can't change.
Mm-hmm.
Then what you're also saying is that God can't change you, which really goes to a core thing of the gospel. You know, the gospel is not simply that we're saved from hell, but also that God is sanctifying us, that the inward work of his Holy Spirit is working in us. So, you know, this gets into whole things of, it's not just holding to certain rules or principles, but you're really getting at some fundamental issues dealing with who God is. And if you're going to go on the path of rejecting the biblical revelation, then you're going on the path of redefining who God is. And I think that's one of the things that becomes important, especially in our day and age, because we're very content to redefine who God is and make him change in all sorts of ways when the Bible doesn't actually say that. And I think having that foundation, having that firm foundation, one, should put more guide rails on how on our thinking. But two, thinking about this beyond just like personal ethics, I think, you know, the doctrine of God is the foundation for any kind of systematic theology. And if you're going to be talking about public theology, you know, how this works in the public sphere, whether that's politics or just, you know, culture writ large, then you need to be working from a whole set of assumptions about the nature of who God is, the nature of man, the relationship between God and man, how reality is constructed, you know, the fact that there is a personal element to reality. Van Til would call it a personal environment, which sounds weird, but when you think of, you know, creation wasn't just, God didn't just make a physical creation.
Right.
That physical creation is infused with a moral order as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, honestly, while people do, a lot of people do public theology without any reference to kind of a systematic basis, if you are doing it rightly, I don't see how you could do it outside of a confessional context, because that confessional context sets the basis for everything. You know, it you're making so many assumptions that you can't work if, unless you already are saying, okay, I'm accepting what the confession is saying as this is what the Bible is teaching. Therefore, now we can start thinking about things on a more systematic level.
Absolutely.
And a more deeper level. Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah, it definitely makes sense. It's really useful. It's a, I think, a good transition, because early on in your work, toward the beginning of this book, you bring up the figure of Alistair MacIntyre. You draw an interesting parallel between Van Til's work and the critiques of moral relativism offered by Alistair MacIntyre. And we can understand how, if we don't have the triune God of the Bible as the foundation of all reality, well, one, the world couldn't exist. Impossibility of the contrary. But we could also see how people might conclude what Van Til would say was irrationalism, or might everything would disintegrate into unrelated particulars. So that could lead to all sorts of moral relativism. There's all sorts of problems there, but specifically MacIntyre's critique, how does Van Til's framework provide a solution to the crisis of moral relativism that MacIntyre identified? And really, I'm also interested behind the question of why you found this such a useful case study to really begin with. It's one of the earlier things in the book.
One of the things, you know, when I was starting down this path of exploring Van Til on ethics, especially since it struck me even early on, he's getting at some foundational things. So who else is writing on the foundations of ethics? And I found really not many people. MacIntyre is still
one
kind
of
the leading guy out there.
Yeah, sure.
And I looked at some of the critiques that were being made of MacIntyre, and you had a lot of secular philosophers going, why are we wasting our time on this? Let's just come up with some principles. We got problems to solve, you know, very pragmatic approach. And, you know, MacIntyre, when he wrote his book initially, was atheist. And he had written back in the 60s, a book called A Short History of Ethics. And I think after that, he realized, wait a minute, there's no real foundations here. So his book After Virtue was his exploration of the foundation of ethics. And he talks about various ethical systems, you know, what we deal with now in terms of principles and virtues and all that, as being the shards of broken ethical systems that had been existed in the past. And he also talked about how in the Enlightenment period, you had folks that were like, let's get rid of religion, but we can keep ethics. We just come up with principles. You know, there's this atomization.
Mm-hmm.
And his conclusion was, our choice is either between Aristotle or Nietzsche. We either go back to the ethical foundations of Aristotle, of, you know, living the life of moderation and contemplation, or we buy into the Nietzschean framework that rejects all of that, and is kind of, we make it all up on our own. First of all, from a pragmatic aspect, just thinking about this in terms of modern day society, if you go to folks and give them a choice of you can live the nice contemplative bourgeois middle class lifestyle, or you can be gods.
Yeah, exactly.
Not thinking that Aristotle is going to come out well on that. McIntyre admits in subsequent editions of his book on the Short History of Ethics that he really didn't give Christian ethics a lot of serious thought. And later on, he ended up reconverting to Roman Catholicism, so he didn't have to change his paradigm all that much because he was taking that Thomistic appropriation of Aristotle. So it was still this kind of atomized, we have different principles. One of the things, I talk about this in the book, personal story of where I was taking a course on, this wasn't at Westminster or at any seminary, but it was a values clarification exercise, which actually clarified my attitude towards ethics more than clarified my values.
Right.
You're given 3 minutes to come up with your seven top values.
Yeah.
And so I'm, well, like the 10 commandments, but that's 10. That's not seven. So,
which ones do we cut out?
So I eventually came up in the 3 minutes I had with the four cardinal virtues and three theological virtues. And that was a Christian thing. I could actually say that, but that wasn't really my framework, but it was Christian. So, but as folks went around and shared their, what they had come up with, even fellow Christians, their values were different. How you define some of those values were different. How do you prioritize those values? Everyone, that's where you have relativism. You know, because we've taken such an approach that's so principle focused.
Sure.
It's very atomized. Basically, you know, I can come up with one set of values. You can come up with another set of values. We can have different priorities on those values. This is why relativism is so pervasive as a problem. And I think it's a problem that is not just, because I think as Christians, especially as conservative Christians, we have a tendency to go, well, relativism is what those guys over there, it's their problem. It's the secularist
right.
problem, but we believe in the Bible.
Right.
But you can get a lot of books that are take a very biblicist approach to ethics. You know, as long as you can find a proof text for it, you can justify anything. And I think what Van Til does, and I think this is why he's, you know, the choice isn't between Aristotle and Nietzsche. It's really between biblical and non-biblical. And really, how do we understand the Bible comprehensively? You know, Van Til is situated, you know, those questions of what are the values? Well, God gives us our values in the Decalogue as well as his other commandments. What are the priorities? Well, the first commandment really kind of takes priority. You know, Christ himself gives us our priorities. You know, the love of God, the love of man. So we have the issue of defining what those principles are. Well, God has done that. You know, the priorities, he's given us that. And then what is the end point that we're aiming towards? Yeah, I know your brothers at on Reform Forum have talked a lot about the deeper Protestant conception.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
You know, God gives us that. Mm-hmm. You know, there is this eschatological arc.
Mm-hmm.
So it's situated in a narrative thing. This is how it pulls it all together. I think this is why Van Til is so important and so different in his approach to ethics. He's not taking an atomistic view. And he's also being able to explain this in a way that is... Yeah, he's interacted with modern theologies, modern philosophies, so he gets that, and he can speak the Bible into that context. But the fact that he's pulling it all together in this comprehensive framework that is both a biblical theology, a comprehensive, you know, covenantal theology, really, but at the same time, because it's systematic, it also can, you can draw the principles out, but they are not decontextualized. So I think that's how he is an answer to McIntyre.
Yeah. I like that a lot. I mean, it's really useful to think of it that way. What's been your take? If people aren't ignorant of Van Til, are unaware, if they have some awareness with Van Til or have interacted with him, what are some typical misconceptions that you've encountered regarding Van Til's approach? Have you found any? And if so, what are they and how can we correct those?
In terms of Van Til's approach to ethics, I haven't found a lot of critique. In fact, I haven't found a lot of engagement, to be honest.
What do you think that is? Just the source material not being widely available?
Part of it may be that, you know, he came out with this, with his syllabus late in his career. He was a few years from retirement when he came out with this. Folks have been more focused on his work on apologetics for good reason, because he's published more on that. One of the things that I have found, I've even had seminary professors say this. It's like, yeah, I don't get Van Til. He's hard to understand.
I know.
I just rely on John Frame to tell me everything I need to know about Van Til. I just want to like hang my head and like, no, just read Van Til.
Sure.
If you want to read Frame, if you want to read others, that's your prerogative.
But get it from straight from Van Til too. Yeah.
I think one of the things, as it applies more to ethics, is Van Til, because he's not exactly easy to read, I'll qualify that here a moment, but people will interpret him by their engagement or their attitude towards like Greg Bahnsen or John Frame.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think Van Til, in one sense, he is easy to read. His prose is clear. It's, you know, in comparison to like reading through Oliver O'Donovan, he's brilliant. But I've had to like take notes along the way, kind of like was it Ariadne in the labyrinth, you know, with the thread. Like I have to take notes, because if I don't write something down on like every page, then I'm going to lose the thread here. Uh-huh. Van Til's not like that.
Right.
But Van Til is assuming a lot on the part of his readers. Mm-hmm. You know, Van Til had grown up in the Christian Reformed Church, so he's fully has the three forms of unity down pat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when he came to Princeton and then Westminster in his time in OPC, he understands the Westminster standards. He's a systematician. He assumes that you know all of this. He's got a PhD in philosophy. He's just like, I'm just making a connection between a few points here. And
right.
You're going, I didn't realize those points existed, let alone that there were connections between them.
Uh-huh.
So that's one of the things that I wanted to do with the book, was bring out some of this larger thinking that he has, so to put it in context. But I also felt, because folks are going to perceive Van Til through the prism of some of his students, you know, do his students actually, are they in line with what he has laid out here? Because some of his students, in the book I focus on, Greg Bahnsen, John Frame, Meredith Klein, if I had more time, another person I would have looked at would have been Jay Adams.
Sure.
Who wasn't a student, but a colleague of Van Til's.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if someone were to read them, are they reading, would they assume that, if they assumed these folks are Van Til students, what conclusions would they draw? Is Van Til a theonomist? Is he a perspectivalist? Is he a Kleinian? I mean, granted, all of those would be anachronisms. I mean, he precedes any of them.
Mm-hmm.
And that was something that I thought needed to be addressed, because they have written stuff on ethics in their own right, but it's very different than what Van Til has written. And there's a few surprises in that regard as well. you know, Van Til was very big, popular in among Christian Reconstructionists and theonomists. But as John Meether points out in his book, in his biography of Van Til, Van Til was not comfortable with theonomy. And I think his difference with Bahnsen would be he is really seeing much, Van Til is taking more of a Vossian approach to understanding the development right. of things while still holding to an absolute standard.
Right, sure.
Whereas Bahnsen tends to flatten that more into a more rigid approach. With Frame has said in various fora that he got his triperspectival approach from Van Til. But Van Til doesn't talk in those kind of perspectival terms.
Mm-hmm, right.
And Frame himself will actually admit that he was exposed to perspectivalism even before he got to Westminster. Mm-hmm. Putting things together in terms of when Van Til taught these things, neither Bahnsen nor Frame studied ethics under Van Til, because Van Til stopped teaching ethics by the time they got to Westminster. So, you know, whatever the merits of their writings on ethics, and, you know, that's a conversation for another time, they're doing their own thing. What was surprising to me as I was looking at Klein in this regard was, even though Klein hasn't written as much, Klein is actually more in sync with Van Til. And Klein actually would have been at Westminster at the time that Van Til taught ethics, and ethics was a required course.
Yeah.
And so, you know, Klein's approach to understanding this in a biblical theological arc, you know, there'd be an interesting comparison. I do a little bit of it in the book, but I think there's more to be done in terms of comparing Klein's intrusion ethics and Van Til's understanding of the development of the ethical standard in the Old Testament. But they're talking in many ways the same language, and I think the differences between them are really nuances. So, you know, for folks, I would say for folks dealing with some misperceptions, if you are judging Van Til on the basis of any of these guys, I would say go back to read Van Til directly and engage with Van Til directly.
No, it's always important to read people and to read the primary sources. It's also useful and instructive to look at the students of people and understand how people's ideas have been appropriated and or developed or changed, and the influence that one person might have on another, regardless of whether the student is carrying on exactly what the teacher thought. There's value in studying that sort of thing, but don't criticize the teacher just because of something that you don't like about the student, whether or not that's accurate. It's important to look at Van Til's writings directly. Looking at his legacy, and I also want to have a bit of a forward focus in our remaining time here, thinking about Van Til's broader impact and how his work has been useful and also will be useful, we pray, into the future. How do you see his contributions influencing future generations of theologians and ethicists within the Reformed tradition, if they are willing to put in the time and the study? Where do you find, or how do you find Van Til's contributions to be most promising, I suppose, or most beneficial to this generation and the ones that follow?
It's a good question, and it's one I'm still wrestling with a little bit. So the thoughts that I'll offer up are really kind of preliminary, but...
Well, we're trying to prognosticate. So anytime we're looking into the future or guessing, you know, there's just... P-values, just probabilities, that's all.
Well, there's a, I think he was a Brazilian writer or something like that. The future belongs to God. And it's like, yep, that's true.
It works.
You know, I think what people are struggling with right now is what kind of a foundation is there for ethics? Because things have been so atomized. And I think if folks are willing to invest the time to read Van Til and engage with him, they will gain a more solid theological and philosophical foundation for Christian ethics. I think that will be, yeah, if folks were to really appropriate that, I think that would be the long-term legacy of putting things back together after they have been broken by the Enlightenment. I think 100, 200 years ago from now, mm-hmm. people are still going to be reading and unpacking Van Til. I've said this to Lane before, and he hasn't corrected me, so that doesn't necessarily mean I'm right, but, you know, there are very few theologians that I can compare Van Til to that have the theological sophistication and the philosophical basis. You know, I think one that is popular nowadays is people are trying to recover Thomas Aquinas.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And I think, you know, Van Til stands in contrast to that. And I think Van Til is, in many ways, every much the equal of Aquinas. That's my personal opinion. And so I think, you know, wrestling, the difference is Van Til is on this side of the problems that modernity has posed. So while I know a lot of scholars are like, yeah, modernity took a wrong turn in getting very epistemological in the questions that it was asking. Okay, fine. That may be a true statement, but it has taken that turn.
Uh-huh.
So you got to deal with it.
Right.
You just can't say, well, you know, we're just going to rewind the clock back to the 1600s and just right. hold on to that. I mean, exactly. Van Til.
Reboot history.
Whether you agree with. Pardon me?
Just reboot philosophical history.
Yeah. I mean, if we could do that, that'd be nice. But, you know, I don't think we can do that. So you have to deal with.
Right.
You have to wrestle with
the way things are.
The aftermath
yes.
of this.
Sure.
And Van Til has done that. Whether you agree with him or disagree with him, and I agree with him, but whether you agree or disagree, he has done that. A lot of scholars haven't. They're just like, well, let's ignore all of that. We'll go back to the pristine nature of the faith, circa 1680. I get a lot out of reading Reformed scholastics, don't get me wrong. I got, you know, the whole bookshelf behind me with a lot of their writings. So mm-hmm. I do benefit from that.
I see some Muller. I see some Turretin, all the good stuff. You're loaded
yeah,
up.
Yeah. Got the Turretin, got the Van Til, unfortunately, is further on the bottom shelf. That's how I ordered the books, not yeah. A sense of priority.
Sure.
But anyways, I think that's what the longer-term legacy of Van Til will be is, you know, going back to the conversation I had with Chad Van Dixhorn, you know, I think he has done in many ways for ethics what he also did for apologetics. He just didn't do as much of it with ethics.
Yeah. And maybe he doesn't need it, but maybe one thing that Van Til's legacy can benefit from is some better marketing. just like,
yes, indeed.
We just got to tell people about it. We got to communicate the value proposition here. In terms of what's going on and the change the messaging, because it's so useful.
Well, there's a bunch of young guys in my church that they're really serious about theology. And I'm thinking, you know, guys, the questions that you're asking, I think we can answer those questions with Van Til.
Yeah.
So I've got to think about how to market this a little bit.
I love it.
More with them, but, you know, there's a richness there that.
Scott, and as people pick up this book, we're going to really try to push it and encourage people to get a copy. If for no other reason, just historically, you're going to want a copy of this Christian Theistic Ethics, but Scott's dealing with a lot of important subject matter in his original contribution, which is the first portion and significant portion of the book. What are the next steps? That people have this book? Do you suggest anything that they might read in conjunction with it or following up with reading Van Til and the Foundation of Christian Ethics?
Definitely read Van Til's Christian Theistic Ethics. You can read my book either before or after as you see fit, but I would say definitely deal with Van Til specifically. Um, depending on where one wants to go, it's hard to recommend. You know, we can go into a myriad of directions. For me, one of the things I'm doing is there are so many issues right now that we are dealing with as a church, as a society, on a lot of those issues are on theological anthropology. So with Van Til, where I'm going with this is I've been doing a lot more reading on things like the nature of man, body and soul. What does that mean? Faculties of psychology. I am finding, I found this in this, my study of Van Til. He draws heavily on Bavinck.
Oh, certainly.
And I have not yet read, I have it, but I have not yet read Bavinck's two volumes
on
of
ethics.
Reformed Ethics.
Yeah, sure.
And I'm also reading right now, Bavinck had a book that was called Foundations of Psychology. It's actually been reprinted. It's book length. It's been reprinted in the Bavinck Review a few years back. And then he's got there's another one that's recently come out on biblical and psychology. Those things, I think, with the foundation that Van Til has provided me, anyways, it's given me an ability to really grapple with that, because Van Til gives the framework. Those things can be built upon. I think if one wanted to get a sense of how this was being used at Westminster, read Van Til's Christian Theistic Ethics and then read Murray's Principles of Conduct
yes,
after that.
It's a great book.
Because they team taught the stuff. So Van Til would teach first semester, which I think was foundations, and then second semester would have been biblical ethical exegesis from the Bible, with Murray teaching that. And yeah, that's kind of, I would say, next steps.
Yeah. I think that's all wonderful. That's a great reading list. I think people would come away and have a much more thorough understanding of Christian ethics as a result. And it's a great place to start. There's so much material out there on ethics, but it's all coming from, not all, but a lot of it is coming from completely different presuppositions, different worldview, even Christian materials, not founded upon the triune God of Scripture as he's revealed himself and as he is. So it's important that we get first things first, we get it correct, that we get these foundations laid and understand what they are, and then to develop our thinking based on that solid foundation. And that's something that Scott is certainly, our guest today, Scott Hatch, is driving us toward. The book, Van Til and the Foundation of Christian Ethics, A God-Centered Approach to Moral Philosophy, which includes, never before seen, brand new critical edition of Van Til's own work, Christian Theistic Ethics. It's all in one wonderful little paperback here, published by us at Reformed Forum. It's well over 270 pages, and it's available now. We got a sale on that going on at reformedforum.org/store if you're watching anytime in the vicinity of when this episode is released, April 2024. Scott, thanks for writing this book. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me today. And I'm praying for the best and asking that your work here would have a wide readership and that people would be driven to think about these things more thoughtfully into the future.
Thanks for having me, Camden. It's been great being here.
Oh, well, much appreciated, and we look forward to your other interviews. I know you've got some other podcasts lined up you mentioned, and I'm excited about that. I'm glad for you, and hopefully this will get things kick-started where more people will be interested, not just in Van Til generally, but in ethics more specifically. So it's wonderful, wonderful. Head on over to reformedforum.org for more information on this and other publications, things we have up our sleeve. Events, all sorts of stuff going on the website. And if you'd like to get in touch with us, you can do so in our community at community.reformedforum.org. If you don't find an answer there, you can send us a note at mail@reformedforum.org. I want to thank everybody for listening. We hope you join us again next time on Christ the Center.